Om namo bhagavate sri arunachala ramanaya. Namaskaram. During the Bhagavan's Aradhana celebrations, I talked about how he clarified the practice of Advaita. And one of the ways in which he clarified the practices of Advaita was by clarifying the nature of ego. So in continuation of that, what I talked about on that day, today I'm going to talk about how he clarified the nature of ego. In all the old texts on Advaita, what is diagnosed as the central problem is what is called avidya. Avidya means ignorance. In this context, ignorance of our real nature. Bhagavan clarified that but that ignorance is nothing other than ego. That ego itself is that ignorance, that avidya. He made this clear in so many ways. One example of how he indicated this in the early days, I think maybe around 1912, or maybe it was even earlier, maybe 1908 or so, he was asked to translate Vivekachudamani into Tamil. That is, there was an existing translation in verse form, but that wasn't currently available in print. So a devotee asked Bhagavan to translate it. So Bhagavan translated the whole of Vivekachudamani, one of Adi Shankara's works, into Tamil prose. And when writing that, he wrote a Mangalam verse, that is a benedictory verse at the beginning of his translation. What he says in that benedictory verse is, Ahamena mula avidye ahandrida, ahamahamaha vallum pahalara, aham oli atma devan padatinil, aham mahilvaha anisam ramikave. What this means is the meaning of the whole verse is, so that the root ignorance called I may depart, may we always delight as in a joy in the feet of Atmadeva, who shines without night and day in the heart as I am I. That is the term he uses here for root ignorance or original ignorance is mula avidya. So in the first line, he talks about mula avidya, that is the original ignorance. He says it is called I. Thereby, he clearly indicates that avidya is what is called ego, that the ego itself is avidya. Before I go on to talk more about that, I'll just talk a little bit more about this first. In Tamil, the word aham has, there are two words, aham, in Tamil. One is a word of pure Tamil origin, which aham means inside, interior. And therefore, it comes to mean heart, mind. It can also mean home, depending on the context. So that is the Tamil word. Also in Tamil, the Sanskrit first person pronoun, aham, is also used in Tamil. So Bhagavan often likes to play on this double meaning of the word aham in Tamil. And of course, though they're two quite distinct words, one is a word of pure Tamil origin, one is a word of Sanskrit origin, their meaning is very closely related, because what is inside is only I. So it's a very happy coincidence, and Bhagavan often played on this. So here he uses in the first line when he says aham enum mula avidya, that is aham there means I, mula avidya called I. In the second line, aham aham aha means as I am I. Again, he's using this in the Sanskrit sense of I. Aham aham means I am I. Though often in English, aham aham or nan nan is translated as I hyphen I. That's not very clear what I mean. What it actually means is I am I, because in Tamil, it's, if you want to say A is B, you just say A, B. The is understood there. So, for example, nan idu, I this means I am this, or nan a, I who means who am I. So that the copula, the verb to be, is understood. If in such a sense. So aham aham means I am I. That is, as Bhagavan clarified, the nature of ego is I am this or I am that. Ego is always identifies itself with some object, something other than itself. So nan idu, I am this, or nan adu, I am that, is ego. Whereas that is a false identity of ourself. Our real identity is only I am I. That is, we are nothing other than ourself. I is nothing other than I. So that is the significance of that term Bhagavan often used, both in Tamil and in Sanskrit. Aham aham is the Sanskrit version, and nan nan is the in Tamil, but even when writing in Tamil, Bhagavan sometimes used the Sanskrit words as he did here, aham aham. And then in the third line begins aham oli atmadevam, atmadevan. There, aham means heart. Atmadevan, which shines in the heart. Atmadevan means self-God, we can take it, but Deva has Deva means God, but the root meaning of Deva is from the verb div, which means shining. So God is that which is always shining. He is that which is Swayam Prakasa. In that sense, God is referred to as Deva. The word Deva is also used to mean to refer to God, the inhabitants of the heavenly worlds, because they are said to be shining beings. But when it's referring to God, it's referring to God because God is that which is always shining by its own light, Swayam Prakasha, which is shining in our heart as I. So Atmadeva means God who is shining in our heart as our own self. That is the implication. So it's a beautiful term, Atmadevan. And then in the final line, Bhagavan uses, when he says, it wouldn't be aham mahirvu, it's aham mahirvu. The inner joy, mahirvu becoming joy or happiness. So, as I say, the whole meaning is, so that the mula avidya called I may depart, may we always delight as inner joy in the feet of Atmadeva, who shines without night and day in the heart as I am I. Here, indirectly, Bhagavan is showing the means by which we can get rid of this mula avidya. How to get rid of this mula avidya? By always joyfully abiding in the feet of Atmadeva. The feet of Atmadeva are that which shines without night and day in the heart as I am I. So to always be, as he says in the first Mangalam verse of Uludunapadu, Ullate ullapadi ullade ulla. Being in the heart as it is meditating on it. So to abiding joyfully in the feet of Atmadeva, those feet are that which is shining without night and day, that is without coming and going, without the darkness, beyond all pairs of opposites, beyond all dualities, in the heart as I am I. But the main reason I wanted to talk about this verse today is because of the first line in which he says, Ahamena Mula Avidya. That is, he's clearly indicating here that what is called avidya is nothing other than ego. Avidya is the opposite of vidya. Vidya means knowledge. So it is often said that avidya can only be dispelled by vidya. But though avidya means ignorance, Bhagavan clarified it's ignorance in a very special sense. That is, we are never actually ignorant of ourselves. We always know ourselves. But what is called avidya is not actually not knowing what we are. It is knowing ourselves as something other than what we actually are. That is, we are always aware I am, but instead of being aware of ourselves as just I am, we're aware of ourselves as I am this or I am that. We're aware of ourselves as we have limited ourselves to a name and form of a body. So that false awareness, I am this body, which is ego, that itself is avidya. So it's not that, this is a very important thing Bhagavan said, because if we were actually ignorant of what we are, then the knowledge of what we are would be something to be newly attained. Whatever is newly attained, as Bhagavan said, if jnana were something to be attained anew, it would also be lost, because whatever comes has to go sooner or later. But jnana is our very nature. Vidya, or jnana, is our very nature. That which is always shining in our heart as I, that is jnana. That is vidya. So this avidya is not a lack of knowledge of our existence. It's a lack of knowledge of that is we are aware that we exist. I am, but we are not aware. We are aware of ourselves wrongly. Instead of being aware of ourselves as just I am, we're aware of ourselves as I am this body. So here, by pointing out that ego itself is avidya, Bhagavan very pointing out of this is beginning to clarify what is meant by avidya. Avidya isn't complete ignorance in the sense of not knowing. It's ignorance in the sense of knowing wrongly. Knowing ourselves as something other than what we actually are. So, in order to get rid of avidya, we need to understand the nature of avidya. So, by pointing out that avidya is nothing other than ego, Bhagavan has opened the door to giving us a great deal of clarification about the nature of avidya. Because if we understand the nature of ego, we thereby understand the nature of avidya. And if we understand the nature of ego, we will also understand how to get rid of it. So that is what I'm going to be talking about today. Bhagavan has revealed a lot about ego. In many of the verses of Ulunaplu, Bhagavan refers directly or indirectly to ego. But the verses in which he talks most, in which he focuses most on the nature of ego are verses 23, 24, 25, and 26. But today I will begin from 24. I won't talk about 23 today, though it's an important verse. It's not essential to talk about it today. We can begin our investigation of ego from verse 24. What Bhagavan says in verse 24, in the first sentence he says, jada udal nane nadu. Jada means that which is not aware. The jada body does not say I. What's he mean when he says it does not say I? This is a metaphorical way of saying the body is not aware of itself as I. And then in the next sentence, he says, Satchit Udiyadu. Satchit does not rise. Satchit, Sat is being. Chit is awareness. Satchit is that fundamental awareness of our own existence. I am. That is what is referred to as Satchit. And that is what is real. And that never rises. It never comes into existence nor ceases to exist. It always shines as it is, as I am. That is our fundamental awareness. Throughout all the three states, waking, dream, and sleep, the one thing that we are aware of in all three states is our own existence, I am. So that Satchit is the one fundamental awareness. That is the one underlying reality. That is what is called Brahman or Atma Swarupa or whatever. But here Bhagavan refers to it as Satchit. Being awareness. So Satchit doesn't rise. So on the one hand, we've got the body, which isn't aware of itself as I. On the other hand, we've got Satchit, which doesn't rise. But in between, something else rises. That's what he talks about in the third sentence. Udalalava, nan ondru, udikum, ideyo. Ideyo means in between. Again, he's using in between here metaphorically, because obviously there can't be, Satchit is the one substance. There can't be any, just like there can't be any space between between gold and gold ornaments. That is, the gold ornaments are nothing but gold. So there's no space between the gold, the substance, and the form. There's no space between Satchit and the body. So when Bhagavan says here, ideal, in between, he's using this term metaphorically. There are two significances of this word in between. Firstly, that is what that eye that rises between Satchit and the Jada body, that is the link between these two. That is why it is called, as he says in the next sentence, it is Chit Jada Granthi. It is the knot that seemingly binds Chit and Jada together. Of course, Chit is ever unbound. Chit is never bound. But from the perspective of ourself as ego, as this Chit Jada Granthi, we seem to be a knot formed by this mixture of Chit and Jada. Chit means Satchit, the real awareness, the pure awareness I am, and this body, which we take to be ourselves. So that's one implication of ideal, that this is the link between Satchit and the body, and consequently the link between the body and all phenomena, because it's only the view of ego that all other things exist. That's one implication of ideal. Another implication is that this eye that rises between Satchit and the body partakes of the properties of both of them. So, for example, if you have read a story in a newspaper and you're not sure whether it's true or not, and you ask someone, is it true? Or is it true or false? That person may tell you it's neither true nor false. It's somewhere in between. What does that mean? It is not entirely true. It's not entirely false. There are elements of truth in it, and there are elements of falsehood in it. In exactly the same way, ego is neither entirely real nor entirely unreal. It's got an element of reality and an element of unreality. The element of reality is Satchit, the fundamental awareness I am. The element of unreality is Jada, the body, what we take ourselves to be, the adjuncts that are mixed and conflated with I am. So this very simple word, ideal, in between, Bhagavan has implied so much in this word. So in between, for poetic reasons, in between comes at the end of the sentence, but actually logically, in between comes at the beginning of the sentence. So in between, udalalava, as the extent of the body, nan ondru, one thing I, udikum, rises. Because it's I is the first person pronoun I, always refers to that which is aware. That is, we can say, what is the basic referent? What is that thing which I basically refers to? It refers to that which is aware. Now we refer to our body and to our mind as I. I am sitting, I am talking, I am thinking, and so on. We refer to them as I, but what I is actually referring to is that which is aware. And because we're aware of this body and mind as ourselves, we refer to them as I, but what I actually refers to is only awareness. That's only that which is aware can be aware of itself as I. So the I always refers to what is aware. So this I, it is awareness. So it's not the body, which is Jada, which it isn't, as Bhagavan says, Jada-udal-nana-dadu-ba. And sentient body doesn't say I. It's not aware of itself as I. So this I is not the body. It is also not the sachet, because sachet udiyagi, sachet doesn't rise, but this I, this one thing called I, udikum, it rises. So it is neither this nor that, but it rises in between, and it rises as, it's I, so it's got an element of awareness in it, but it limits itself as a udalalava, as the extent of a body. So this is the, this is ego. So this, what he goes on to say in the next sentence is, Idu chit jada granti. This is chit jada granti. This is the knot that binds chit and jada together as if they were one. That is the chit element is I am. The jada element is the body. But this false awareness, I am this body, that is chit jada granti, and that is ego. So he first said this is chit jada granti. Then he says bandham. It's bondage. That is, there's no bondage other than this false awareness, I am this body. What we actually are, the pure awareness I am, is free, because there's nothing, it is ekameva advaitiam, it's one only without a second. So since there's nothing other than it, there's nothing to limit its freedom. So our true nature is infinite freedom. But when we limit ourselves as the extent of a body, we seem to be bound. So it's called bandham. Jivan, that is jiva, jiva means soul or life. Not life in the sense of prana, but in a deeper sense, so we can take it as soul. The original meaning of jivan is life. Jiva here means the soul, so it's what is referred to as jiva. Nupame means subtle body. It's a Tamil term, but it's equivalent of the Sanskrit term sukshma sarira. Here, Bhagavan is giving a rather unconventional meaning to the term subtle body. The reason Bhagavan refers to ego as the subtle body is it is generally said, what is it when this body, when this physical body dies, what is it the idea is transmigration. We leave this body and we go to some other body, as if these bodies were something independent of ourselves. But that's the general understanding of samsara, of birth and death. But the subtle body leaves one body and it goes and it takes birth in another body. But what actually takes birth is only ego. And even it's not moving from one body to another body, as Bhagavan clarified, they say every life is just a dream. So it's not that we are migrating from one body to another body to another body. We dream a dream. When one dream comes to an end, we fall asleep, and then again we start dreaming again. All the numerous births are nothing but a long series of dreams. And what is common to all these dreams is only ego. But when ego goes from one dream to another dream, what it takes with it is its vasanas. Those vasanas are what are sometimes, vasanas collectively are what are sometimes referred to as the karana sarira or anandamaya kosha. But that those vasanas are the seeds that give rise to all vishayas. So the other four sheaves, the intellect, the mind, the prana, and the physical body, they are all carried over in seed form. So those same seeds that have now projected this body and mind will project another body and mind. In each dream, those seeds are projected as a body and mind. So, and as well, indeed as a whole world. Bhagavan said the Vishaya Vasanas, Vasanas means the inclination. So the inclination to be aware of Vishayas, those inclinations are the seeds that give rise to everything. So the whole universe is nothing but a projection of our Vasanas. So what goes from one body to another body, from one dream to another dream, is only ego. That's why Bhagavan refers to it here as subtle body, because of the general belief that it's a subtle body that migrates from one body to another. That's why he refers to ego here as subtle body. So subtle body, if you read normal textbooks on Vedanta, they'll say subtle body consists of the pranamaya kosha, manamaya kosha, and vijnanamaya kosha. And these in turn are separated into, are further subdivided into seven 17 parts, the five pranas, the five sense organs, the five organs of action, and the mind and the intellect. So the pranamaya kosha is split into 15, and this vijnana, manamaya kosha and vijnanamaya kosha. But all these, we shouldn't confuse what Bhagavan is saying here with that. That is, Bhagavan is using a subtle body here in a special sense, because this is what is carried over from one life to another. Then the next term he uses is ahande. Ahande is a Tamil word that Bhagavan uses a lot. Though it's a Tamil word, it's a Tamil form of a Sanskrit word. The original Sanskrit word is ahanta. Ahanta means I-ness. Ahanta is the equivalent of the English suffix ness. So ahanta means I-ness. So sometimes Bhagavan used the term ahankaram, but generally the term he used to refer to ego is ahande. So this is Chicharagranti, bondage, jiva, subtle body, ahande. And then he says, ichamsara, this samsara. So what Bhagavan is indicating here is for the whole of samsara is in essence nothing but ego. Ego itself is what expands as all this vast samsara, in which we all seem to be caught up and seem to be for so many countless jhanmas. So this samsara is nothing but ego. And it is also manam. That is, as Bhagavan clarified in verse 18 of Upadesha Undia, for example, enangale manam. Thoughts alone are mind. That is, generally, we use the term mind as a collective term to refer to all thoughts. However, as he says there, enangale manam, yavinam, nanenam enname mulamam. Of all, that means of all the thoughts that constitute the mind, the thought called I is the root. What he refers to here is the thought called I, that is ego. That often Bhagavan used this term thought called I as a synonym for ego, because ego is nothing but a thought. But of all thoughts, it's the first thought, it's the root thought. Why is it the root thought? Because unlike all other thoughts, ego is the only thought that is endowed with awareness. So all other thoughts exist only in the view of ego. So without ego, there can be no other thoughts. So he says, of all thoughts, thought called I is the root. And then he concludes that verse by saying, yanam manameno, what is called mind is only I. That implies what is called mind is only ego. That is, as what the mind essentially is ego. So that's why he says here, this one thing called I that rises between body and satchit, that is, not only is it ego, it is also mind. And he ends with the word en, which means know this. So the meaning of the entire meaning of the verse is, the insentient body does not say I. Satchit, being awareness, does not rise. In between, one thing, I, rises as the extent of a body. Know that this is Chicharagranti, bondage, jiva, subtle body, ego, samsara, and mind. So here Bhagavan has clarified what is the nature of ego. It is neither satchit nor is it the body. It's some spurious entity that rises in between the two. Does this mean then, okay, I'll talk about this later. I mean, one wrong inference we could make from this verse is, oh, there are two things. There's satchit and there's a body. And in between, something else rises. There are no two things. What actually exists is only satchit. The insentient body exists only in the view of ego. That is, the body doesn't exist independent of ego. When we rise as ego, we project the body and take it to be ourselves. And that will be clarified in the next two verses. So in the next verse, verse 25, this is a very, very important verse. I will start with the last line, because in the last line of this verse, Bhagavan, but what he's talking about, he says in the last line. In the last line is, Urupatra Teyahandi pay a hande or means know or investigate. Uruvatra pay a hande means formless phantom ego. Why does he say it's formless? Because ego has no form of its own. And why does he say it's a phantom? Because it's got no substance of its own. It borrows its form from the body, and it borrows its substance from Satchit. Substance means its existence and awareness. It borrows from Satchit. So what it actually is only Satchit. But it borrows its form from the body. So it's neither Satchit nor the body, but a confused mixture of the two, a conflation of these two. But as I say, he said, this is in the last line that he says, Uruvatra Payahande, because in verses you don't have to put things in the logical prose order. But that is in the last line. How he begins, so that is what he's talking about in this verse. In the first line, he begins by saying, Urupatri Undam, Urupatri Nekam. Urupatri Undam means it comes into existence grasping form. It here means that formless phantom called ego. That this formless phantom ego comes into existence grasping form. That is, it has no form of its own. But it cannot exist without grasping a form. The form that it grasps as soon as it comes into existence is the form of a body. So as soon as we rise as ego, we project a body and experience that body as ourself. We can see this from our experience in dream. As soon as we begin dreaming, we seem to be a body in that dream world. So that dream body obviously doesn't exist before we start dreaming. As soon as we rise as ego in dream, we project the dream body and take it to be ourselves. And it's only when we grasp a body as ourselves that that ego comes into existence. So though ego has no form of its own, it cannot come into existence, cannot seem to exist without grasping a form as itself. So Urupatri Undam, grasping form, it comes into existence. Urupatri Nikam, grasping form, it stands. That is, so long as we remain as ego, we continue to grasp the form of the body as I. That's why Bhagavan said, ego is nothing but this false awareness, I am this body, as he described in the previous verse, as he implied in the previous verse. That is, that false I, but rises as the extent of a body. That is, the false awareness, I am this body. So without grasping a body, ego cannot come into existence and it cannot stand. And having grasped the body as I, through its five senses and through the mind of that body. Because when Bhagavan talks about body, it's very important to remember, as he says in verse 5 of Uludhanapadu, Udal Pancha Kosa Uru, the body is a form of five sheaths. Because we never experience only a physical body as ourselves. Whenever we experience a physical body as ourselves, that physical body always seems to be alive. No one has ever experienced a dead body of themselves. And it also seems to be awake. So because it's alive, the pranamaya kosha is there. And because it's awake, the manamaya kosha, the mind, that's the grosser functions of the mind, the vijnanamaya kosha, the intellect, and the anandamaya kosha, the will, all of these seem to exist within that body, and we experience them collectively as ourselves. So long as we grasp this form of five sheaths as ourselves, through the five senses we perceive what seems to be an external world, and within the more subtle of the sheaths. We experience an inner world, a mental world of thoughts, feelings, emotions, perceptions, memories, reasoning, desires, likes, dislikes, and so on. These are all the subtle, the manamaya kosha, the prajnanamaya kosha, the anandamaya kosha. This internal world is consisting of these three. having grasped this form of a body, we then become aware of so many other things. We become aware of what seemed to be a physical world outside. So many physical objects seem to be there. And so many mental objects are there. So many thoughts, feelings, emotions, desires, attachments, all these, there's a whole inner world of mental world. These are all forms. Why are they forms? Because anything that can be distinguished from any other thing is a form. So every thought is a form, every feeling is a form, every desire is a form. We can distinguish one thing from another. So when Bhagavan talks about form here, he's using the term form in a very broad sense. So having said that ego comes into existence grasping form, it stands grasping form. Then in the third sentence, he says, Urupatri undu mika ongam, grasping and feeding on form, mika ongam, it flourishes abundantly, or grows abundantly. That implies that ego is fed and nourished and flourishes by grasping form. All the forms it grasps are things other than itself, because ego itself is a formless phantom. Ego is the subject. All objects are forms. Objects of all types are forms. So whether it's physical forms or mental forms, also events, anything that happens, that is also a form. It's something that's distinguishable from something else. By attending to things other than ourselves, ego feeds itself and flourishes. And since it cannot stand without grasping form, if it leaves one form, it grasps another form. So in the next sentence, he says, Uruvittu Urupatram. This we can take it as from moment to moment, the mind is constantly flitting from attending to one thing to attending to another thing. We can take it in that sense. We can also take it in the sense that when we leave one body, we grasp another body. That is when we fall asleep, and begin to dream, we've left this body of the waking state and we project some other body in dream. And then when we wake up from that dream, we leave that body and we grasp this body. And likewise with death, when this body, the life of this body comes to an end, we leave this body and we go and grasp some other body. So Uruvittu Urupatram covers all of those. Uruvittu means leaving form. Urupatra means grasping form. So leaving form, it grasps form. But then the most important sentence of all in this verse is Tedinal Otam Pidikam. Tedinal means if it seeks, very, very literally, if it seeks, but there's no clear subject there. But it's because in English we can't say, we can't form a sentence. We can't form an active sentence without having a subject. So it's easy. The sense of Tedinal is best conveyed in English, though it's an active verb. It's best conveyed as a passive. If sought, otum pidicum. Otum means running. Pidicum means grasping. So it grasps running. In other words, otum pidicum is an idiom in Tamil, very similar to the English idiom, it takes flight. In other words, it runs away. This is a metaphorical way of saying, but if we investigate ego, it will subside and disappear. Why will it subside and disappear? Because we seem to be ego only so long as we're grasping form. If we try to grasp ourselves, because we are a formless phantom, we will subside and dissolve back into our source. So, Tedinal here, if sought, who is to do the seeking and what is to be sought? Well, obviously, what is to be sought is ego. And who is to do the seeking? It is ego. So, if ego seeks itself, so it's not, though the verb means seek, what it implies here is if ego investigates itself, if ego, instead of attending to things other than itself, if ego tries to attend to itself, it will subside and dissolve back into its source. It will take flight. So in this verse, Bhagavan reveals something about ego that I don't think has ever been revealed so clearly. But the nature of ego is to rise, stand, and flourish by attending to things other than itself. That's what the first two lines imply. But if instead of attending to itself, instead of attending to other things, if it tries to attend to itself, it will subside and disappear. In other words, we seem to be ego only so long as we're looking away from ourselves at other things. If we look back at ourselves to see what we are, this ego will subside and disappear, because ego is a formless phantom. It doesn't actually exist. It's got neither a form of its own, nor has it got any substance of its own. It borrows its form from the body, and it borrows its substance from Satchit. So if we look at it, when we turn our attention away from other things, back towards ourselves, we are thereby letting go of the body, because body is one of the forms that ego is grasping. If instead of grasping the body, if we try to grasp ourselves, what remains when we separate ourselves from the body, what remains is only I am. And since I am doesn't rise, because I am is Satchit Udiyadu, by grasping I am, we subside back into our source. So when we investigate ourselves, though ego, as Bhagavan said, it is a false awareness, I am this body. Even this we need to, what does it mean when Bhagavan says that ego is a false awareness, I am this body? It is that which is aware of itself as I am this body. So that which is aware of itself, if it tries to catch itself, it has to let go of the body. And what is, when it lets go of the body, what remains for it to grasp? Only I am. So when we, that's why in Maharshi's gospel, in one place where Bhagavan's explaining about this, this practice of Atmavichara, he says, in your investigation into the source of the aham vritti is another, aham vritti is a Sanskrit term that means I thought. So it's the Sanskrit equivalent of what Bhagavan called nananum ninebu, a thought called I. In other words, it's ego. So aham vritti means ego. So Bhagavan says, in your investigation into the source of the aham vritti, you take the essential. Oh, he explained just before that, but ego is chit-chara-granti. And so he says, in your investigation into the source of the aham vritti, you take the essential chit aspect of ego. That is, we don't try to investigate the body, which is jada. We try to investigate the chit element of ego. That is, I am. So when we are investigating ourselves, we are trying to hold only on to I am. When we try to hold on to I am, we thereby subside and merge back into our source. There's no separate thing as ego to be found. If we look to find ego, it's like, if we are walking along on a path with Bhagavan in the dim light of dusk, and we see something lying on the path ahead of us, we take it to be a snake. Bhagavan assures us, no need to fear. It's not a snake. It's just a rope. But still, to us, it very much looks like a snake. So we continue to, we are not able to dispel our fear all at once. So what does Bhagavan say? He doesn't say, believe me, because merely believing is not going to dispel our, he says, look at it and see for yourself. Look closely. If we trust in Bhagavan's words, we will look very closely at that snake. And what will we see? Oh, it's not a snake, it's only a rope. Likewise, if we look very closely at ego, what do we see? We see it's only that pure awareness I am. So just like the snake takes flight if you look at it, ego takes flight if we look at it. What remains when you look, if you look at this snake very carefully and it takes flight, what remains then is just a rope. Likewise, if we look at ourselves very carefully, ego will take flight, and the underlying reality of ego, the pure awareness I am, Satchit, alone will remain. So the Bhagavan here is revealed so the nature of ego, and this is this verse. If we understand this verse, it will be clear to us why Bhagavan emphasized that self-investigation is the only way to get rid of ego. Because so long as if we're not attending to ourselves, we're attending to something else. If we're not attending either to something else or to ourselves, we subside in layer, in sleep, or in Nirvikalp Samadhi, or whatever it's called, or any state of Manolaya, is just because when we go into Manolaya, we go into Manolaya through some means other than attending to ourselves, simply by withdrawing our attention from other things, ego will subside in Manolaya. But in order to bring about Manonasa, the destruction of ego, it's necessary to let go of everything else. As Bhagavan says in verse 16 of Upadeshundia, Veli Videngale Vittu, leaving external phenomena, Manam Tan Oli Uru Ordale Undipara, Unme Unuchiam Undipara. The mind knowing its own form of light alone is real awareness. So here he says, what is to know its own form of light? It's the mind. In other words, in Laya, whether in sleep or in Nirvikalpa Samadhi, ego has already subsided, and then only the pure awareness remains. But in order to bring about, so because the ego is absent there, that pure awareness, which shines alone in the state of Manolaya, doesn't destroy ego, because ego is absent. So we need to bring about that experience of pure awareness here in the waking or dream state. That is, we as ego need to experience ourselves with pure awareness. So that's why he says the mind knowing its own form of light. As soon as the mind knows its own form of light, mind here, it means ego. As soon as ego knows its own form of light, that is its pure awareness, it ceases to be ego or mind, because it's ego or mind only so long as it knows itself as I am this body. But when it attends to itself so keenly that it thereby leaves all external phenomena, it thereby merges back in its source. And that state in which the mind knows its own form of light, it knows itself with pure awareness, and is thereby swallowed by pure awareness, that alone is real awareness. So all these verses, that Bhagavan has explained this in so many ways, and these are all so closely connected. So in this verse, Bhagavan reveals to us what is the nature of ego. The nature of ego is to rise, stand, and flourish by attending to things other than itself. So if our spiritual practice entails attending to anything other than ourselves, that may help to purify the mind if it is done with love. But it cannot bring about the destruction of mind, because ego is being sustained so long as we are attending to anything other than ourselves. In order to bring about the dissolution of ego, the permanent dissolution of ego, ego needs to cease grasping form by grasping itself. It needs to grasp itself. That is the key to the practice taught by Bhagavan. Ego needs to attend to itself. If ego attends to itself, it takes flight. It will subside and dissolve back into its source. And what will then remain is only its source, which is that fundamental awareness I am, that Satchit that Bhagavan referred to in the previous verse. So when we read this, we may come to the conclusion, the previous verse Bhagavan talked about the ego rising between body and Satchit. And here he says it comes into existing grasping form. So does this mean that the forms exist independent of ego? The forms are there and Satchit is there, and in between something called ego called rises? No. It's only when we rise as ego that everything else comes into existence. That is, the forms exist only in the view of ego. As soon as we rise as ego, we project and experience these forms. So this is made clear by Bhagavan in verse 26, the next verse. What he says in verse 26 is, Ahande Undayan, if ego comes into existence, Anetum Undahum, ego comes into existence, everything comes into existence. Everything here means all forms, all phenomena, everything other than ourselves, everything other than the fundamental than Satchit, which never rises or subsides. That is what is permanent. But when ego rises, all other things, all phenomena, all forms, all names and forms, all objects come into existence only when ego rises. Why is that? Because all other things exist only in the view of ego. So Without ego, nothing else exists. So if ego comes into existence, everything comes into existence. Ahande indrel indruanatum. If ego doesn't exist, everything doesn't exist. But why? As I say, because the ego is the subject. Without the subject, there cannot be any objects. Objects appear only in the view of the subject. So ego is the subject. All other things are objects. So they appear only in the view of the subject. So without the subject, other things don't exist. Then he says, Ahandeya Yavamam, ego itself is everything. Why is ego everything? Because it is everything else seems to exist only in the view of ego. So it borrows its seeming existence from the seeming existence of ourself as ego. So what we as ego see as all other things, as all the thoughts and feelings and memories and perceptions and the whole world, is nothing but we are seeing ourselves as all these things, just as in dream. In dream, we see a whole world with people and bodies, and inside our mind, we are aware of thoughts and feelings, and we have desires for certain things and aversion for certain things, and we feel likes, dislikes, and fear. When some monster comes, we want to run away. So we experience all these things. But when we wake up, we realize all those existed only in our own mind. So it was nothing but ourselves, our own mind, but we were seeing as all these things. So this is the sense in which Bhagavan says, Ahande Yavamam, ego itself is everything. That ego is the substance that appears as all these, all phenomena. Just like gold is the substance that appears as so many ornaments, ego is the substance that appears as all these, so the subject is what appears as all the objects. The objects have no, they borrow their existence from the existence of the subject. The subject means ourself as ego. So everything depends upon ego. Without ego, there's nothing else. And then he concludes this verse by saying, Adalal, Yadu Idu Endru Nadale, Uvadal Yavamenao. Therefore, investigating what this is giving up everything. Why is it giving up everything? Because when he says Yadu Idu, Idu refers to ego. When we investigate what this ego is, investigating what this ego is itself giving up everything. Why? Because to the extent to which we attend to ourselves, to that extent ego subsides. And to the extent that ego subsides, everything else subsides along with it. So if we attend to ego keenly enough, ego will, Kedana Lotum Pitikom, it sort it takes flight. It will subside and dissolve back into its source. When ego dissolves back into its source, everything else that exists only in the view of ego will subside along with it. So, investigating what this ego is giving up everything. So this is Bhagavan taught us the ultimate path of renunciation. Bhagavan never asked us to take sannyasa or Bhagavan wasn't interested in external renunciation. Bhagavan said, if it is that all the external life goes on according to prarabdha, if it is our prarabdha to be married and have 10 children and have a responsible job and so many things, that is going to happen whether we like it or not. We can want to run away from it, but if it's our destiny, we have to experience it. On the other hand, if it's our destiny to be a sannyasi, we'll be a sannyasi. So all these things are to do with prarabdha. Ultimately, it doesn't matter whether we're a sannyasi or we're a householder seemingly in the midst of samsara. Whether we are aware of ourselves as I am a sannyasi or I am a grahastha, I am a renunciate or I am a worldly person, what is common is only I am. Holding on to I am, that is true renunciation. Because if we hold on to I am, everything else will drop off. So Bhagavan teaches the path of renunciation, but not merely the path of outward renunciation. He teaches the path of inward renunciation. And it's up to us. Do we want to renounce or not? If we have sincere love to know and to be what we actually are, we will turn our attention within and thereby give up everything. But we can't have our cake and eat it. So long as we are attached to anything other than ourselves, we are not going to be willing to turn within and surrender ourselves completely. So complete surrender means surrender of ego. When ego is surrendered, everything else is surrendered with it. So we need tremendous love to follow this path that Bhagavan has shown us. Bhagavan's path, though it's often considered to be the path of jnana. Yes, it is the path of jnana, but it's also the path of bhakti. This is the ultimate bhakti. That is, the greatest form of bhakti is surrender. Because what greater love is there than to give oneself? So self-surrender is the pinnacle of the path of surrender, of the path of bhakti. And the pinnacle of the path of surrender is atmavichara, because we cannot surrender ego entirely without investigating it. Because as Bhagavan said in the previous verse, the nature of ego is to rise, stand, and flourish by grasping form, and it will subside and disappear only by, so it will subside and disappear only by grasping itself. That is why in the 13th paragraph of Nana, Bhagavan begins by pointing out the oneness of self-investigation and self-surrender. What he says in the first sentence of that 13th paragraph of Nana is, Anma chintane tavira, vera chintane kalambavadaku, satram idam kodamal, apmanishta paranai iripade, tanne isanaku alipadam. What that means is, being apmanishta paran. Apmanishta paran means one who is firmly established, fixed as oneself, and who is abiding as oneself, being what we actually are. So being apmanishta paran, giving not even the slightest room to the rising of any chintana, any thought, except atma-chintana. Atma-chintana literally means thought of oneself. It implies self-contemplation or self-attentiveness. In other words, self-investigation. That alone is giving oneself to God. So the whole sentence is, being apmanishta paran, giving not even the slightest room to the rising of any thought other than self-attentiveness, alone is giving ourselves to, giving oneself to God. In other words, we need to be so keenly self-attentive that we thereby give no room to the rising of any other thought. That is surrender. So though Bhagavan sometimes talked about self-investigation and self-surrender as if they were two alternative paths, because they're actually just two ways of presenting the same thing. Some people are more attracted to the idea of investigating and knowing what they actually are. Other people are more attracted to the idea of surrendering themselves wholly to God. Actually, they are both one and the same. So when we get down to the practice, we cannot surrender ourselves to God without holding firmly to self-attentiveness. And that is the true bhakti. Why? Because God is that which is shining in our heart as eye. So Bhagavan's teachings are so simple, so complete, and so coherent. Every element of Bhagavan's teaching ties in with every other element, whether it's Arunacha Stuti Panchakam or Uludunapadu or Nana. There's so many, the same themes are woven in all these works. For example, Uludunapadu, Bhagavan ends by saying, destruction of ego is mukti. And he begins, Aksharam Lai, Arunachala Mena, Ahamenine Pava, Ahatever Arupai Arunachala. Arunachala, you root out the egos of those who meditate on you in the heart as I. That is the word Ahame there, has two meanings. It can mean both heart. So Ahame can mean in the heart. Ahame can mean only I, who know that Arunachala is only I. So those who think of Arunachala as I, that is, you root out their ego. So whether it's Arunachala Stuti Panchakam or Uludunapadu or Nana or whatever it is, Bhagavan has one aim and one aim alone. That is Ahateve Arupai, eradicating, rooting out ego. That is the aim of Bhagavan's teaching, and that can be achieved only by self-investigation and self-surrender. Om Namo Bhagavate Sri Arunachala Ramanaya.